Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Almost exactly 154 years ago from when I'm recording this episode in mid-February of 2018. So back in February of 1864, to be specific, February 20th, 1864, on that day, the only significant Civil War battle in Florida took place. And that's using the word significant a bit lightly, because by the standards of the major theaters of this war, wherein battles could be 10 times the size of this one in Florida or more in terms of total numbers involved, this was basically not much more than a skirmish. The battle is known as Olustee. During the Civil War, very little in the way of real battles took place in Florida, although there was small-scale and often irregular fighting in various places. In fact, in one of my Patreon bonus episodes about the naval aspects of this war, I mentioned some of the naval and amphibious operations that took place in and around Florida, so you may want to check that out if you're not already, and of course, you gotta sign up for $5 a month there at patreon.com/profcj, but anyway, in general, for most of the war, the situation in Florida was that the Union controlled most of the major port cities and towns in the state, which they were able to do because of their naval supremacy. However, they had no success and only made a few efforts to establish any significant influence or control over the interior of Florida, which at the time was largely a remote frontier region. And in many ways, both the Confederate and Union governments had limited logistical capabilities to directly control interior Florida for most of the war. Florida was the most frontier state east of the Mississippi River for sure, and in many ways, much of interior Florida away from the coast was as much of frontier as anything out west. That said, despite the fact that even the Confederate government had a tough time really controlling a lot of things going on in Florida, Florida was clearly a Confederate state during the war. If you'll recall from way back at the start of the Not-So-Civil War series, it was the third state to secede, with only South Carolina and Mississippi beating it, and Mississippi only beating it by, if memory serves, a day or two. Florida will also be the last Confederate state to officially surrender at the end of the war, and it fielded more Confederate soldiers per capita than any other Confederate state, though in absolute numbers this was still quite small, as Florida, as I've indicated before, was one of the most lightly populated states in the U.S. at the time. And also, by the way, Florida's capital, Tallahassee, was the only Confederate capital east of the Mississippi to not be taken by Union forces during the conflict. And perhaps in a future episode, I'll tell the story of the one Union attempt made to take Tallahassee in a serious way, which failed, and it's a very, very interesting story. So I might cover that in a future episode in this series. But back to the Battle of Olustee. The Union military seized Jacksonville, not for the first time, in early February. They had seized it before and then had left it, I believe, when there were battles elsewhere and reinforcements were needed in places that were considered more important and urgent. But the thing was, because of their naval dominance, the Union could pretty much land and take any coastal city in Florida that it wanted. So Union forces take Jacksonville in early February and then quickly begin making forays westward, and for a while encounter no significant resistance. Lincoln's proclamation of amnesty and reconstruction, which was issued in December of 1863, said that a state could be brought back into the Union in good standing if 10% of its voters took an oath of allegiance to the Union. The Lincoln administration thought they might be able to take control of Florida and get it to meet that 10% qualification in time to get Florida to vote for quote-unquote honest Abe's re-election in November of 1864. And basically, they thought they could get Florida reconstructed under Lincoln's policy and then basically have an election in which it would be made impossible for anyone with real strong Confederate sympathies to vote and thus kind of rig it for Lincoln. Which, by the way, they essentially did do for the 1864 election in Tennessee and Louisiana, although Congress chose not to count the electoral votes from those states in that election. Union General Truman Seymour was in command of the 10th Corps, about 5,500 soldiers occupying Jacksonville. And like I said, he began making some raids and forays into the interior of Florida, and they ventured as far as Gainesville and briefly held it, but then pulled back to Jacksonville. About a week after the Gainesville foray, Seymour mobilized most of his forces to march westward along the railroad line out of Jacksonville, which is basically today what Interstate 10 is in North Florida in terms of the route. Their initial objective was Lake City, which is about halfway between Jacksonville and Tallahassee, though they seem to have been hoping that if everything went well, perhaps they'd be able to go as far as Tallahassee and take it. More immediately, they very strongly hoped to cut access from Florida up into Georgia to cut off the supplies of various important foodstuffs that Florida was sending to the Confederate war effort. General Seymour's army consisted of a collection of regiments from northeastern states, including three colored regiments, one of which was the famous 54th Massachusetts. So basically, the goals of the expedition were to cut off supply of important commodities, most important of which were salt, beef, and pork that were coming from Florida and being sent northward to the rest of the Confederacy. They also were hoping that they could find slaves along the way that they could free under the Emancipation Proclamation and then recruit them as either soldiers or laborers. And then, as I've already gone through, get Florida reconstructed, quote-unquote, in time to vote for Lincoln in 1864 for re-election by only allowing pro-Union Floridians to actually vote. Attempting to thwart Seymour's expedition was a Confederate general named Joseph Finnegan, who managed to gather together a force of about 5,000 men and decided that a place called Olustee, which is near Lake City, would be the most advantageous ground on which to try and fend off the Union incursion. This battle would be a relative rarity for Civil War battles, in that the two sides were actually pretty evenly matched in terms of overall manpower. General Finnegan's Confederates had been brought in from elsewhere because most of Florida soldiers had already been dispatched to places far away, and so I believe the bulk of his soldiers were brought down from Charleston and also from some other neighboring areas close to North Florida. Despite having virtually no intelligence about the Confederates' numbers or positions, when Seymour encountered this force, he ordered his men to attack, although there was a fair amount of confusion and lack of coordination between the various regiments in this offensive. The battle began around noon and lasted for approximately 6 hours. And as a resident of North Florida, all I can think is, these guys were really lucky that this was happening in February, when the weather is usually pretty nice, because if this battle had taken place in the summer, probably more men on both sides would have dropped from heat and humidity than from bullets, especially considering those heavy wool uniforms they wore. Now, aside from just command problems, coordination of the Union attacks was also hobbled by the terrain. Now, this is Florida, so we're not talking mountains or anything like that, but this battle took place in kind of a forest of tall pine trees, which is very common in north and central Florida. And so probably slash pines, loblolly pines, longleaf pines, or some combination thereof. And these are pine trees that are often very similar looking in appearance. And this pine forest, all these trees, caused the Union units to get broken up and scattered and created a lot of additional confusion besides just the arguable incompetence of a lot of the Union commanders in this battle. The consensus of historians who are very knowledgeable about this battle is that the Union soldiers fought hard, but were very poorly led. Now, as is the case in most Civil War battles, the side playing defense had the advantage and won. And in this case, it was the Confederates who were generally more playing defense, and so it was easier for them to hang together, to have unit cohesion, because they were essentially just defending against attacking Union forces, which were having all these difficulties of coordination and so on. And so the Confederates at Olustee ended up winning a rather decisive victory. When late in the day the Union forces were in danger of being outflanked, they began to retreat back to Jacksonville, and two of the Black Union regiments fought a very difficult rearguard action to cover this retreat, and this was another case where Black soldiers distinguished themselves in battle and proved that they could be just as brave and just as good of soldiers as whites. In part because of the efforts of these two Black regiments, the Confederates failed to really follow up the win quickly and missed the opportunity to crush what was left of Seymour's army. In the aftermath of the battle, Confederate troops at Olustee took wounded white Union soldiers prisoner, but when it came to the Black soldiers, they gave no quarter and took no prisoners, and Black Union soldiers who fell into Confederate hands were mostly either killed on the spot or sent into slavery. Sometimes atrocities were also committed against the white officers who were commanding colored regiments. Total Confederate losses for the Battle of Olustee were 93 killed, 847 wounded, and 6 missing. Union losses were 203 killed, 1,152 wounded, and 506 missing, and probably, we would imagine, a lot of the missing here were Black soldiers or their white commanders who were killed rather than being taken prisoner in the aftermath of the battle. Now, having nearly 2,000 casualties, and remember, when you hear casualties, it counts killed, wounded, missing, and prisoners. Having nearly 2,000 casualties out of a force that was only a bit over 5,000 means that the Union suffered approximately a 40% casualty rate at Olustee, making it one of the highest casualty percentage battles for the Union forces in this entire war. I believe only one or two other battles actually had a higher casualty rate for the Union. And not only did the Confederates succeed in protecting against this Union incursion into interior Florida, but they were able to capture a lot of really much-needed equipment and supplies, including 9 cannon, 39 horses, 1,600 small arms, and about 130,000 rounds of small arms ammunition. While the Union was making its long retreat back to Jacksonville, which took several days, on February 22nd, the 54th Massachusetts was ordered to help a Union train that was loaded with Union wounded and which had broken down. And the men of the 54th Massachusetts Colored Regiment attached ropes to the train and physically pulled it 3 miles in order to get it to a place where horses could be attached to it to pull it the rest of the way back to Jacksonville. Union General Seymour pulled his army back to Jacksonville and there made preparations to defend. He was sure the Confederates would launch a massive attack to try and capitalize on their success, and the Confederates seemed to have been planning to do so, and they followed to within about a dozen miles of Jacksonville. And there they waited, gathering reinforcements and preparing to attack, but before they could, they were ordered to go northward to go assist other Confederate forces in other battles. Again, it was ironic that most of the Confederate troops who fought at Olustee weren't even Floridians, but were instead rushed into Florida from, like I said, places like South Carolina, Georgia, and Alabama. As a result of this battle, Florida would not participate in the 1864 Union election, and the Union wouldn't make any more significant efforts to try to seize control of Florida's interior for the remainder of the war. There's going to be one effort that they're going to make to try and take Tallahassee, but that actually is a surprisingly small number of Union troops who were involved in that. And that's a story for another day. Did this battle really make a giant impact on the overall war effort? Not really, because Florida, while it was an important source of supplies for Confederates, was not a hugely strategic state, in part because it was rather isolated and remote. But it was an interesting microcosm of the war in a lot of ways and where things were going, and in particular, the fate of the black Union soldiers there and some of their white commanders at Olustee showed how nasty this war was becoming and was a portent of similar atrocities happening on a larger scale in cases such as the more famous Fort Pillow massacre that took place a few months later in Tennessee. There, a Confederate cavalry division led by Nathan Bedford Forrest took a Union outpost, defended by about 550 Union soldiers, about evenly split between black and white. The fort was overwhelmed and taken by the Confederates, and many of the black soldiers were killed after putting down their arms and trying to surrender. Later investigations of what happened at Fort Pillow revealed eyewitnesses who said that the Confederate soldiers were yelling things like, "No quarter," and "Kill the damn niggers." Nathan Bedford Forrest himself supposedly did not actually order or condone the massacre, but he also did nothing at all to try to intervene to stop it. After events such as Olustee and Fort Pillow and some other massacres of black soldiers, such as Milliken's Bend, in the words of historian Harry Stout, quote, "Black soldiers vowed no quarter on their own part and fought under the banner, Remember Fort Pillow. With black soldiers now in combat and no quarter given on either side, the Civil War had turned the corner toward a race war," end quote. And as we'll see over the remainder of this episode, this was turning into a total war in more ways than just that. Hey everybody, this is CJ, your one-man revolution, guerrilla scholar warrior, and Renaissance man. In this new and seemingly ever-darkening dark age in which we find ourselves these days, back with another heaping helping of hazardous history. This is episode 157 of the Dangerous History Podcast, I Was Killed, the Not-So-Civil War Part 10. And this is going to cover primarily Grant's so-called overland campaign in Virginia in 1864. Originally, I was going to do one giant episode overall on the coming of total war in 1864, and I was going to cover both this campaign of Grant's as well as Sherman's campaign in Georgia. But as I was putting the notes together and everything, I realized that that would be just way too big, and it would take me forever to get it done, and it would be a giant episode. And so I decided instead that I would break it into two parts. This is the first, again, primarily focused on Grant's campaigning in Virginia in 1864, and then the next Civil War episode I make most likely will be the one covering what Sherman was doing in Georgia at the same time. But before we resume the story, I have some important announcements to make. First off, this episode of the Dangerous History Podcast is brought to you in part by Live Tea or Die. LiveTeaOrDie.com specializes in witty libertarian, voluntarist, objectivist, and anarcho-capitalist t-shirts and apparel. Use discount code LIBERTY and receive 10% off your entire purchase. The link will, of course, be in the show notes for this episode. And again, that's LiveTeaOrDie, spelled L-I-V-E-T-E-E or D-Y-E.com. LiveTeaOrDie, liberty you can wear. Patreon shoutouts. Awesome individuals who have stepped up to help support the show over at patreon.com/profcj. Big thanks to Christian, Van, Barry, Mateo, Dave, Nicholas, Scott, Aben, and Skyler. Thank you all very much for stepping up to help support the show. And I also have a thank you for something off my DHP Amazon wish list. Big thanks to BT, my collaborator on the Modern Day Grunt's Eye Perspective series, for being kind enough to get me the very interesting looking book, The Great Illusion, a study of the relation of military power to national advantage by Norman Angel, which is a very interesting book I was tipped off to by David Ramsey Steele that was written, I believe, a bit over a century ago, largely in the context of the British Empire, but basically making the argument that states that pursue a foreign policy of imperialism in the name of promoting their own prosperity are actually shooting themselves in the foot from the perspective of the economy as a whole, is my understanding of the overall thesis of the book, and I'm very interested to read it, so thanks, BT. And speaking of BT, hopefully I'll be talking with him again in the near future for another installment in the Modern Day Grunt's Perspective series. But the past few weeks he and I have just had scheduling conflicts, but we should be able to reconnect soon, so stay tuned for another installment of that. And also, as always, I've got other stuff in the works. And in between DHP episodes, you can always catch up on back episodes of the show. And of course, you can always check out some of my appearances on other shows. The most recent one being my appearance on Free Man Beyond the Wall with Mance Rader, which was a good conversation I think you will enjoy. Also, another announcement. I'm excited to announce that I've recently joined a network of history podcasts called Recorded History, and it's a very diverse group of history-related podcasts of all sorts of types, working together for things like advertising deals and cross-promotion. And you can check out the Recorded History page at recordedhistory.net, and I'll put a link in the show notes as well, and you can see if there are any other shows there you might be interested in checking out, since, after all, I can only put out so many doses of DHP a month. So, back to the Not-So-Civil War. Where we last left off, the overall Civil War narrative, which was back in episode 147, The Sparring of the Amateur Boxer. Ulysses S. Grant had just been appointed as Lieutenant General, a rank which I believe had not existed since George Washington, and which Lincoln resurrected just to give to Grant. And with this, he was in overall command of Union forces, and he and his friend, William Tecumseh Sherman, were determined to crush the Confederacy at any cost. At the start of the year 1864, the total number of soldiers in uniform counting both sides was nearly 1.5 million men. So, when you're determined to beat the other side at any cost, that gives you a lot of bodies to work with. Historian Harry Stout writes that by 1864, for both sides, North and South, generals, quote, stood as the warrior priests of America's dawning civil religion, entrusted with making the sacrificial blood offerings that would incarnate the national faith, end quote. And in Ulysses Grant, the Union seemed to have finally found someone who could win, and who could be put on a similar pedestal to the one that Robert E. Lee had already been put on for a while down south. On March 24, 1864, Grant met Abraham Lincoln in person for the very first time at the White House. At this meeting, Grant stressed that his number one priority was to get Lee, and within 2 days, Grant was with the Army of the Potomac in the field in Virginia, trying to put his plans into action. The details of his plan were shared with no one ahead of time, not even Secretary of War Edwin Stanton or Chief of Staff Henry Halleck, not even President Lincoln himself. Lincoln, for his part, was desperate for Grant to try to crush the rebellion, if possible, before the November elections, or if not able to completely decisively knock out the Confederacy. He at least wanted to win some major victories before then, because Lincoln believed, probably correctly, that if things didn't go well for the Union over the course of the spring through fall of 1864, he would probably not be reelected. And there's a good chance that if he wasn't reelected, some sort of negotiated settlement with the Confederacy might be forthcoming. Grant's plan was basically to try to coordinate all the different Union forces in order to bring pressure on the Confederates simultaneously at a bunch of different points, so that they wouldn't be able to concentrate reinforcements at trouble spots, as they had done so successfully on previous occasions. Grant believed that a major reason why the Union hadn't been able to clinch victory yet, despite its overwhelming advantages in men and materiel, was that up till this point in the war, the various Union armies in the field had done a rather poor job of coordinating their operations, which often, like I said, allowed the Confederates to shift troops around in order to meet particular threats in particular places. The Army of the Potomac, which was, of course, the main Union army in the East and the one that Grant was going out to personally oversee, was in kind of a weird situation in terms of its command structure, because General George Meade, the victor of Gettysburg, technically still remained as the head of that specific army. But now, of course, Grant was there personally in the field and obviously outranked him and was really in charge. Meanwhile, Grant's two real right-hand men, William Tecumseh Sherman and Philip Sheridan, were off elsewhere. Sherman will be taking the Army of the Tennessee from southeastern Tennessee down through Georgia, and Sheridan will be operating in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. Grant really wanted to go on offense on all fronts so that no other Confederate forces would be able to reinforce Lee's army, which Grant intended to go after relentlessly. And in the process, he also, Grant, intended to threaten Richmond as well, in part because he knew that by doing that, he would kind of make Lee's army have to hang around and fight all the time. The strategy would be one of total war, built on the two pillars of, number one, attrition, and number two, targeting civilians. This would mean massively escalating body counts on the battlefield and increasingly deliberate harm on an increasingly mass scale to Southern civilians. Because of the timing of his promotion, Grant had a somewhat late start for the military campaign season of 1864, and he wasn't able to make any significant changes to the command structure or the overall procedures or culture or anything like that of the massive Army of the Potomac, much as he probably would have liked to, because as we've kind of indicated previously in this series, the Army of the Potomac, in contrast both to the Union Army of the West and the Confederate Army of Robert E. Lee in the East, the Army of the Potomac tended to be very slow to move or to act. A lot of its subordinate commanders were very hesitant to take the initiative and act quickly and decisively to seize opportunities, all these sorts of things. So very different from what Grant was used to with the Union armies out West. But because of the political situation of the upcoming Union election of 1864, he felt that he had to strike at Lee as quickly as possible, so he basically had to put the Army of the Potomac into the field as it was in order to pursue his goal of getting after Lee as quickly and relentlessly as possible. The 3-year terms of enlistment that many Union soldiers had signed up for at the start of the war, these were starting to end in the spring of 1864, and politically, the Lincoln administration and Congress felt that it could not forcibly extend those enlistments, which, by the way, was something that Jefferson Davis did in fact do in regard to Confederate soldiers. But instead, the union government relied on inducements of financial bonuses in order to encourage reenlistments, aside from, as you might expect, sort of guilt-trippy propaganda. And as a result, nearly 60% of Union soldiers whose enlistments were coming up in spring of 1864 actually did reenlist. Now, Grant knew his side had a massive advantage in men and material, and his army, of course, numbered around 120,000, vastly dwarfing Lee's army, which probably stood at most at about 65,000. So Grant had almost a 2-to-1 advantage in manpower. So he knew he could win a war of attrition as long as he was willing to keep it up as long as it took to do this. However, the degree to which Grant really preferred to follow a strategy of attrition is somewhat questionable. Sometimes it's characterized that way as that's what he wanted to do. But when you look at how he operated in the West, he actually didn't rely on attrition very often when he could avoid doing so. So probably attrition wasn't Grant's plan A, but he certainly was willing to use attrition if maneuver proved impossible, if victory primarily by maneuver proved impossible. So later he wrote that he had resorted to trying to, quote, hammer continuously against the armed force of the enemy and his resources until, by mere attrition, if in no other way, there should be nothing left to him but an equal submission with the loyal section of our common country to the constitution and laws of the land. End quote. Historians Williamson Murray and Wayne Sia believe that the reason Grant had to resort to attrition in this theater rather than relying more on maneuver was the Army of the Potomac itself, that it had this culture of being very slow and cautious and by the book, and subordinate commanders not seizing the initiative when opportunities presented themselves, again, in contrast to the Western armies which Grant had previously led, and that combined with this was the uneven quality of the subordinate generals in the Army of the Potomac. You know, a few of them were pretty good, but a lot of them were rather incompetent. And this made a war of finesse and maneuver simply not a valid way to try and use this large but rather slow and cumbersome army against Lee's force, which was, of course, much smaller, but also in a lot of ways more nimble. So Williamson and Sia write, quote, "The problem was not that Grant knew only how to bludgeon an opponent into submission, but rather the instrument at his disposal, the Army of the Potomac, was incapable of fighting in any other fashion." End quote. Historian Harry Stout, who is more concerned with the moral calculus of things like ends and means, writes of this willingness to engage in attrition warfare if necessary, quote, "No proportionality of losses could mitigate against this end. Moral reflection about acceptable losses could not even be part of the equation. Instead, pragmatism must define the line between acceptable and unacceptable losses, and the cost would be high indeed. War was becoming its own end. 1864 would stand as the moral crossroads of a war pursued with unprecedented violence on soldier and civilian alike." End quote. And it would be quite a bloodbath. Over the course of about a month, from the Battle of the Wilderness through Cold Harbor, basically spanning from early May to early June of 1864, Robert E. Lee would lose about 32,000 men, or 46% of his forces, while Grant would lose about 50,000 men, which was about 41% of his forces. The Confederate Army, for its part, had had a very hard winter on short rations over the winter of 1863-64, and manpower, which had always been an issue for them, was really becoming a problem. The Confederacy had increased its overall conscription system, doing away with things like purchasing of substitutes and requiring all who were in the army to actually continue to serve through the duration of the war or until they were killed or injured so badly they could no longer serve. And the Confederate government was at least attempting to try to draft every able-bodied white man between the ages of 17 and 50. Yet amazingly, as far as we can tell, in Lee's Army of Northern Virginia, Morale nonetheless remained high, as did the men's faith in Lee himself. And at least part of this morale was due to evangelical religious revivalism that was sweeping through the Confederate armies during this time period. And a lot of this is chronicled in great detail by Harry Stout in his excellent book that I frequently refer to in this series, Upon the Altar of the Nation. By the way, out in the West, something that we'll get to in most likely the next Civil War episode, General Joseph Johnston, who had taken over command of the Confederate Army of Tennessee from the horrible Braxton Bragg. Johnston had also somewhat improved the morale of that Confederate army, although morale still was nowhere near as high as the morale in Lee's army. But anyway, that's a story for a different day. So basically, Grant was going to throw everything he could at the Army of Northern Virginia, and Lee was actually going to turn in some of his most skillful performances, in part because his very depleted army forced him to fight much more defensively than he had for the first half of the war. And one can't help but wonder how much better Lee's army might have done over the course of the war if they'd fought defensively the whole time. Trench warfare and other forms of intricate prepared defenses were going to heavily characterize this particular campaign. And one Union officer wrote of this trend, quote, "The great feature of this campaign is the extraordinary use made of earthworks. When we attack on the ground, it takes, of course, a considerable time to put troops in position for attack. Meantime, what does the enemy? Hastily forming a line of battle, they then collect rails from fences, stones, logs, and all other materials, and pile them along the line. Bayonets and a few picks and shovels in the hands of men who work for their lives soon suffice to cover this frame with earth and sods, and within 1 hour there is a shelter against bullets, high enough to cover a man kneeling and extending often for a mile or two. It is a rule that, when the rebels halt, the first day gives them a good rifle pit, the second, a regular infantry parapet with artillery in position, and the third, a parapet with an abattis in front and entrenched batteries beyond. Sometimes they put this 3 days' work into the first 24 hours." End quote. When you combine this trend with Grant's determination to keep up the offense against Lee's army at all costs, in other words, his willingness to accept attrition if necessary to break the Army of Northern Virginia, you have a recipe guaranteed to produce ever-worsening body counts. A Confederate soldier in Lee's army wrote of the experience of coming up against Grant's leadership, quote, "We had begun to understand what our new adversary meant. That the policy of pounding had begun and would continue until our strength should be utterly worn away. We began to understand that Grant had taken hold of the problem of destroying the Confederate strength, and the only way that the strength of such an army, so commanded, could be destroyed, and that he intended to continue the plodding work till the task should be accomplished, wasting very little time or strength in efforts to make a brilliant display of generalship in a contest of strategic wits with Lee." End quote. A little bit more on this trend of trench warfare. Clearly, a lot of the things that were characterizing the trench warfare of this point of the Civil War, it was getting increasingly common, standard operating procedure, and rather sophisticated. And many of the things that were becoming common in large battles in this period in Virginia even anticipated a lot of the things we associate with World War I. But of course, they weren't yet evolved to the same degree that that war would produce. And, you know, the small arms and artillery were clearly not as effective as during World War I, but they certainly were getting more effective all the time. But the armies in the Virginia campaign of 1864 did often construct trenches, sometimes with multiple lines, and with these abattis obstacles made out of felled, sharpened trees in front. Historians Williamson Murray and Wayne Sia describe this as follows, quote, "By 1864, the soldiers on both sides had absorbed the lesson that bullets killed, and that needless exposure displayed stupidity rather than bravery. The tactical framework within which the armies were fighting had altered drastically in favor of the defense, which, with its artillery and infantry solidly ensconced behind palisades of logs, branches, dirt, and stones, could slaughter attacking formations moving on open ground. End quote. Of course, another way in which this campaign of this war was starting to be a precursor or a preview of the First World War was in the growing size of the battles, including their durations, sometimes now lasting a week or more, which, again, reflected this strategy of attrition, which also became the dominant strategy of the First World War. All of these ominous developments would converge and culminate with the result of staggering carnage in Virginia in mid-1864 in the campaign that is often called Grant's Overland Campaign. The first battle of Grant's Overland Campaign in Virginia would become known to history as the Battle of the Wilderness, and it took place basically in the same area as the Battle of Chancellorsville the previous year. After midnight on May 4th, the Army of the Potomac crossed the Rapidan River in Virginia. Lee didn't oppose the crossing, but instead waited north of Richmond, in the thick forest known as the Wilderness, again that same area around where the Battle of Chancellorsville had occurred the previous year. Lee hoped that he'd be able to use terrain and his army's knowledge of it to mitigate Grant's advantages in manpower and artillery. The thick trees and undergrowth of the Wilderness, wherein visibility was generally just a few yards at best, would make this a chaotic battle in which it would be hard for units to coordinate and communicate with each other, and which Lee, of course, hoped might make the Army of the Potomac size into perhaps more of a liability than an asset. And it was really a lot of thick brush and, at the time, rather dry, a lot of it. And this was mostly not big old-growth forest. That had been chopped down long ago by colonial settlers in the area. So this is mostly smaller trees and then kind of thick undergrowth. Harry Stout writes of the terrain where the Battle of the Wilderness would occur as follows. Quote, "The dark forestation was so thick with small pines and scrub oak, cedar, and dogwood that visibility all but ended beyond 10 yards, making coordination between large military elements virtually impossible." End quote. Grant, for his part, didn't actually want to fight in the Wilderness itself, and split his army into two pieces in order to try and get it through the Wilderness as quickly as possible, but Lee was determined to make the battle happen in the Wilderness. Grant had issued orders beforehand that any part of the Army of the Potomac was to attack ASAP if they encountered any part of Lee's army. So the battle actually began with a chance encounter on the Orange Turnpike when a Union Corps bumped into a Confederate Corps. The Union Corps, at first, didn't realize the size of the Confederate force that it had encountered, in part because the Union cavalry was not doing a good job of recon, one of the main jobs of cavalry in this war. But both sides quickly realized, once the shooting started, that this would be a major engagement as an additional corps from each army joined the battle. And again, it quickly turned into somewhat chaotic small unit fighting in this dense undergrowth. A soldier who participated in the Battle of the Wilderness described the close quarters battle as, quote, "simply bushwhacking on a grand scale, in brush where all formation beyond that of regiments or companies was soon lost, and where such a thing as a consistent line of battle on either side was impossible." End quote. On the Confederate side, the Third Corps, led by A.P. Hill, really distinguished itself with an excellent defensive fight against overwhelming numerical odds, but by the end of the day's fighting, they were pretty depleted, including Hill himself, who was not in good health. And still, Longstreet's corps hadn't arrived at the battle to join it yet. One very interesting incident in this battle illustrates both the confusion of operating in the Wilderness and also the Army of the Potomac's habit of not exercising initiative quickly and taking advantage of circumstances. So what happened was that at one point during this first day's battle in the Wilderness, a group of Confederate commanders, including Jeb Stuart, A.P. Hill, and even Robert E. Lee himself, were gathering with their staff officers in a somewhat open area to decide what they were going to do next, and all of a sudden a group of Union skirmishers emerged from the brush right in front of them. Now, both groups were totally stunned, but the Union skirmishers, instead of doing their best to shoot the Confederate commanders or maybe try and force them to surrender as prisoners, apparently this group of Union skirmishers instead, what they really prioritized was they realized they weren't where they were supposed to be, and somehow they thought that was a more important thing than trying to kill or capture some of the top Confederate generals in the entire war. And so as a result, these Union skirmishers quickly pulled back to their own lines without firing a single shot. Historians Williamson and Murray write of this, quote, "Ironically, by not acting, most had signed their own death warrants. Had they killed or wounded the leading Confederate generals, particularly Lee, the campaign would have taken a decidedly different turn," end quote. The next morning, Grant planned and started to launch a massive attack aimed at A.P. Hill's corps, which again had done a good job defending the previous day but was really used up. But then in the nick of time in the morning, Longstreet's corps began to arrive. Lee, of course, was delighted to see them, and the feeling was mutual. The first on the scene were a brigade of Texans, and Lee waved his hat, cheering at them, yelling, "Texans always move them!" Lee began riding forward with the Texans as if to personally lead a counterattack, but the Texans and Lee's own staff officers and ultimately even Longstreet himself convinced him to not personally lead the counterattack. The counterattack that Longstreet's corps carried out was actually a smashing success and allowed the Confederates, who'd been close to breaking in some spots, to recuperate and to reform their lines. However, during the midst of his success, Longstreet was hit and fell off his horse, wounded in the neck and coughing up blood. Like Stonewall Jackson a year earlier, also in the Wilderness, in fact, only about 4 miles away from the spot where Longstreet was hit was where Jackson was hit. Like Jackson, Longstreet had been shot accidentally by some of his own pickets, a victim of friendly fire. Longstreet turned over command to a guy named Charles Field and told him to press the attack, but the attack ended up faltering and dissipating in the confusion, and the Union troops on the other side were able to regroup. Longstreet would, of course, live. He would recover from his wounds, unlike Jackson, but he would be out of action for 5 months as he recovered. On the other side of the Confederate lines, General John B. Gordon found that the Union Army's right flank was exposed and vulnerable, and that the men there were busy eating. Gordon wanted to attack, but Jubal Early, his immediate superior, wouldn't let him. Hours later, somebody, either Richard Ewell or Robert E. Lee himself, different sources say different things, okayed Gordon's attack, by which time it was almost dark. Gordon's attack was initially very successful, but because of the late hour, it couldn't be properly exploited to its fullest potential. And for the rest of his life, Gordon complained about this major missed opportunity to inflict serious damage on the Army of the Potomac. Confused, small unit fighting continued in the Wilderness into the night, with friendly fire incidents becoming relatively common, and the brush of the Wilderness, which, as I said, was rather dry, began to catch fire in many places due to the shooting of small arms and artillery, and as a result, fires began to sweep through the Wilderness, and hundreds of wounded men and animals who couldn't move away from it were killed either by burning or by suffocation. A Union private described the scene as follows, quote, "I saw many wounded soldiers in the Wilderness who hung on to their rifles and whose intention was clearly stamped on their pallid faces. I saw one man, both of whose legs were broken, lying on the ground with his cocked rifle by his side and his ramrod in his hand and his eyes set on the front. I knew he meant to kill himself in case of fire. Knew it as surely as though I could read his thoughts." End quote. At this point in the evening, some of Grant's subordinate generals began fretting about how Lee would exploit all of this, and it would be a disaster, and it was in response to this that Grant somewhat famously said, quote, "Oh, I am heartily tired of hearing about what Lee is going to do." Some of you always seem to think he is suddenly going to turn a double somersault and land in our rear and on both of our flanks at the same time. Go back to your command and try to think what we are going to do ourselves instead of what Lee is going to do. End quote. Which shows you how much the Army of the Potomac had been psyched out by Lee over the course of the war, and Grant was doing his best to try to shake them out of it. The next morning, which was May 7th, Grant faced the Army of Northern Virginia, which was now well dug in the wilderness, and Grant, probably wisely, chose not to launch a direct assault, but instead began planning to maneuver southeastward in order to try and seek battle on more favorable real estate. The Army of the Potomac had suffered over 17,000 casualties. Now, of course, remember, casualty doesn't mean just killed. That's a combination of killed, wounded, and missing. The Confederates had suffered far fewer, a total of only about 7,500, but Lee had lost Longstreet to his wounds and also A.P. Hill, who at that point was too sick to remain in the field by the end of this battle. Now, in terms of who won, the Battle of the Wilderness is often characterized as a really bloody draw, because neither side really achieved a major goal out of it. And even though the Confederates suffered a lot fewer casualties, they, of course, had a lot less ability to bounce back and replace the men they lost. Grant began moving his army as quickly as he could toward the little town of Spotsylvania Courthouse, where a bunch of the area's roads converged, and Lee was able to figure out where he was headed and decided he needed to try to get there first. Lee was starting to realize, as were many of his men, that he was facing a very different opponent than previous Army of the Potomac commanders. That Grant, unlike someone like, say, McClellan or Hooker, who would have probably pulled back out of the area after suffering the casualties they'd just suffered in the wilderness, that Grant was different, that he was willing to absorb the losses and to keep coming. Interestingly, the one high-level commander in the Army of Northern Virginia who knew from before the get-go that Grant would be this relentless, even before clashing with him on the field, was actually James Longstreet, who, believe it or not, had been, many years ago, Grant's best man at his wedding. Longstreet had told a Confederate officer very early in this campaign, before the major fighting began, quote, "We must make up our minds to get into line of battle and to stay there, for that man will fight us every day and every hour till the end of the war," end quote. Historian Harry Stout describes Grant's grim determination and the fact that much of the population on both sides, including the people back home, were just as grimly determined as Grant to fight on, whatever the cost. Stout puts it like this, quote, "For the first time, Lee faced a general who would press on the offensive no matter what the cost in human sacrifice. No moralists moved to caution Grant. To the contrary, the people cried for more. Grant's strategy left no room for nuance. At that moment in the wilderness, with Grant's decision to press on, the fate of the Army of Northern Virginia was sealed. But not even Grant could estimate the butcher's bill that Lee would extract. Had the soldiers sensed that millions back home would have been morally aghast and outraged at the looming slaughter, desirous only of peace, neither Grant nor Lincoln nor all the statesmen on earth could have impelled the soldiers forward. In this war, however, citizens on both sides cried for no surrender," end quote. So, as with so many wars in American history, had the people really been dead set against it rather than ginned up for it, it might have ended a lot more quickly and with a lot less effusion of blood. So our next major engagement of this campaign is going to be the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse, which is going to be one that lasts for over a week altogether. Lee's army did make it to Spotsylvania first, in part because the Army of the Potomac did its usual job of moving very slowly. But Lee's army got there just barely first, and they quickly began frantically entrenching in the way that I described earlier. Though forced for the most part by size and circumstance to be defensive, Lee still hoped he might be able to catch some sort of opportunity to strike offensively against the Army of the Potomac when they were unprepared and not entrenched. Grant, for his part, was determined to attack, and over the course of nearly 2 weeks, launched first a series of frontal assaults and then flanking attacks, but he just couldn't clinch a win. 6 days into the Battle of Spotsylvania Courthouse, in a message to Henry Halleck, Grant said he was bringing in additional supplies and was determined to, quote, fight it out on this line if it takes all summer, end quote. One of Grant's major attacks that he launched, and probably the most notorious one of this battle, was on May 12th, directed at a spot nicknamed the Mule Shoe, which was a salient in the Confederate lines that bulged out about a mile from the rest of their lines, a spot which the Confederates had significantly fortified because they understood its potential vulnerability. The sounds of the Union's preparation for this massive attack were not detected by the Confederates as they normally probably would have been because of a huge thunderstorm that came in. By the way, the Scott Miller song, The Rain, is about this part of the Battle of Spotsylvania, and I'll link to it in the show notes. It is a haunting and beautiful in a melancholy and sad and tragic way song. Now, the Union attack, which, because of the thunderstorm, had the element of surprise, at first appeared to be stunningly successful, until John B. Gordon yet again managed to lead a bloody counterattack. It seems like John Gordon is the master of the effective counterattack. In this savage fighting at this spot that also got nicknames like the Death Angle and Bloody Angle, soldiers fought separated by no more than 50 yards and sometimes less. And this included the largest and longest instance of mass hand-to-hand fighting in this war, in a 1,500-yard-wide trench. Bodies piled up in some of the just most gruesome close-quarters fighting of the whole war, and soldiers fought back and forth over the piles of dead bodies from both sides. Entire large trees were chopped down just by the volume of rifle fire, so you can imagine what happened to the bodies of people. The fighting went on in this area for almost a full 24 hours. Historian Harry Stout writes, quote, "All discipline broke down as the soldiers devolved into wild men. When ammunition ran dry, they threw bayonets like spears or used their rifles as clubs to beat the enemy senseless. Even the dead were re-enlisted in this fight, as soldiers shaped the hands of their dead and dying comrades to hold cartridges, so that those fingers stiffened in a cupped position would provide ready access to ammunition. Finally, at midnight, the exhausted rebel survivors fell back, wild-eyed, mad, with the horror of non-stop killing. More than 5,000 Confederates lay dead or wounded alongside 6,000 Yankees, many of them pressed so deep in the mud by the feet of their comrades that their features could not be discerned." End quote. Horace Porter, an aide to Grant, described the aftermath of this fighting as follows, quote, "The appalling sight presented was harrowing in the extreme. Our own killed were scattered over a large space near the angle, while in front of the captured breastworks the enemy's dead, vastly more numerous than our own, were piled upon each other in some places 4 layers deep, exhibiting every ghastly phase of mutilation. Below the mass of fast-decaying corpses, the convulsive twitching of limbs and the writhing of bodies showed that there were wounded men still alive and struggling to extricate themselves from the horrid entombment. Every relief possible was afforded, but in too many cases it came too late. The place was well named the Bloody Angle." End quote. And a Confederate sergeant wrote about the scene at Bloody Angle after the fighting, quote, "I found these trenches filled with water, for there had been much rain, and in this water lay the dead bodies of friend and foe commingled, in many instances one laying across the other, and in one or more instances I saw as many as 3 lying across one another. All over the field lay the dead of both armies by hundreds, many of them mangled by shells. Many of the bodies swollen out of all proportion, some with their guns yet grasped in their hands. Now and then one could be seen covered with a blanket, which had been placed over him by a comrade after he had fallen. These bodies were decaying. The water was red, almost black, with blood. Offensive flies were everywhere. The trees, saplings, and shrubs were torn and shattered beyond description. Guns, some of them broken, bayonets, canteens, and cartridge boxes were scattered about, and the whole scene was such that no pen can or ever will describe it. I have seen many fields after severe conflicts, but nowhere have I seen anything half so ghastly. I returned to my company and said to old man Thomas Carroll, a private in the company who was frying meat at a fire, "You would have saved rations by going with me, for I will have no more appetite for a week." End quote. So this absolutely apocalyptic-looking aftermath of the battle, again, is a dark preview of World War I in a lot of ways. There were several days of mostly a lull in the fighting at Spotsylvania, and then a last fight at a place called Harris Farm that ended up being a bit smaller and less bloody than what had happened at Bloody Angle. At Spotsylvania, the Union had suffered 18,000 casualties, and the Confederates had suffered around 12,000. In the face of the body count, some Northern critics began to call Grant a butcher. However, many more Northerners continued to support the sacrifice in the name of this nationalist cause of theirs, as did most of the South for their own nationalist side. The civil religion and the belief in blood sacrifice that went along with it was very strongly rooted in both sides by this point in the war. Harry Stout puts it this way, quote, "By 1864, the language of martyrdom and sacrificial altars was instinctual and through sheer repetition forming a national consensus and literally incarnating a powerful new religion of patriotism." End quote. Now, while Spotsylvania was happening, there was a cavalry battle known as the Battle of Yellow Tavern that took place on May 11, 1864, that for just a cavalry versus cavalry battle was pretty large, although it was tiny compared to something like Spotsylvania. But nonetheless, this ended up being an important engagement to the history of the war. So Yellow Tavern took place relatively close to Richmond, and it was between Philip Sheridan's Union cavalry, who had been detached from the Army of the Potomac to go on a raid, and the Confederate cavalry of Jeb Stuart. And the Union won, thanks in part to a numerical advantage and also to an assault led by a young brigadier named George Armstrong Custer. And while this battle didn't matter in most kind of strategic ways to the overall course of the campaign, it was important because at this battle, Jeb Stuart, one of the Confederacy's top most successful cavalry commanders, was killed. And it was kind of a portent of the fact that increasingly, the Confederate cavalry in the East would start to be losing its advantage that it had had up till then in the war in terms of overall skill. Now, the next big battle of the campaign after Spotsylvania would be at Cold Harbor. Grant maneuvered towards Richmond, knowing it would cause Lee to try and engage and block him. The two armies collided at Cold Harbor and again quickly set about building trenches and abatis and other fortifications. Lee's back was basically to the wall, with no hope of reinforcements and nowhere to retreat, so his army set about making their defenses as stout as the terrain and their expertise could possibly manage. After 2 days of attacks on June 1st and 2nd, the commanders of the Army of the Potomac believed that one last massive assault on Lee's lines might just break him. If this is starting to sound a bit like Gettysburg with the two sides reversed, then you're catching on. General Meade, who'd been kind of chafing at just being Grant's lackey, persuaded Grant to give him full field command of the Army of the Potomac for the day of this particular attack. However, Meade shouldn't get all the blame because Grant concurred with the attack that Meade launched, so really both men deserve some of the quote-unquote credit, or perhaps blame. Union soldiers who were going into battle to carry out a massive frontal assault at Cold Harbor on the day of June 3rd were so pessimistic about their own odds of surviving the attack that they started using a primitive form of dog tags. They would have slips of paper pinned to their uniforms on which they would write their name and address. And one soldier even apparently wrote ahead of time in his diary before he went into battle, quote, "June 3rd. Cold Harbor. I was killed." End quote. And he was right. This diary was found on his dead body after the battle. At 4:30 a.m. on June 3rd, the Army of the Potomac launched an attack that consisted of three entire corps, an attack that Harry Stout calls, quote, "tragically brief and criminally expensive." End quote. Some of the attacking Union soldiers had to pass through a ravine in which they were complete sitting ducks for Confederate riflemen. This attack ended up being just as wastefully suicidal as the frontal attacks at Gettysburg or the frontal attack at Fredericksburg earlier in the war. Another tragic parallel to World War I is generals always being tempted to try and make the one last big offensive, and it almost never ever working out. In the space of about 1 hour, all three of the Union Corps who were carrying out this attack were pushed back with very heavy losses, suffering around 7,000 total casualties to the Confederate defenders of fewer than 1,500 casualties. One eyewitness said about this scene, quote, "It was there I experienced or realized the awfulness of war. The wounded were everywhere under every tree and bush. Holes were dug in the ground near the tables, and I saw them actually filled with amputated limbs." End quote. In his memoirs, Grant expressed regret for ordering the assault on June 3rd at Cold Harbor, writing, quote, "I have always regretted that the last assault at Cold Harbor was ever made. I might say the same thing of the assault of the 22nd of May, 1863 at Vicksburg. At Cold Harbor, no advantage whatever was gained to compensate for the heavy losses we sustained. Indeed, the advantages other than those of relative losses were on the Confederate side." End quote. Abraham Lincoln, while maybe he was disturbed by the body count and by Grant's error at Cold Harbor, still stuck with Grant and stuck with the attrition strategy as necessary to crush the Confederacy. Harry Stout writes this of Grant's decisions at Cold Harbor, the resulting body count there, and how this has been handled by historians and others ever since. Quote, "For the most part, American military historians agree, chalking the episode up to bad judgment, forgiving Grant because he admitted his mistake, and then moving on to the next great battle. In this way, Americans past and present managed to record and solemnize battlefield deaths without judging them. Somehow, in ways they could not explain then or now, Americans accepted the levels of destruction as secondary to the work of national redemption America's God required." End quote. After the fighting, Grant and Lee communicated with each other directly over how to handle the piles of wounded soldiers who hadn't yet been carried from the field. Though by the time this was happening, most of Lee's wounded, who were much fewer in this battle, had already been taken care of. Grant's message to Lee asked for a 3-hour truce to deal with the wounded. Lee stuck to the traditional rules of honorable war at the time, which dictated that the loser of the battle, which in this case would be Grant, would have to raise a formal flag of truce before this could happen. Grant refused to do this, and Lee refused to budge on his demand for it. So, not until June 7th, a full 2 days after the exchange of messages, did Grant finally cave and raise the flag of truce, by which time all but two of the scores and hundreds and thousands of Union wounded were actually dead, their corpses bloating in the summer heat. Many of Grant's own officers were furious at his stubbornness that had caused so many wounded men to die. Cold Harbor would be the last major battlefield victory for Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia for the entire war. It would also be the last time that either of the two main armies in the East were foolish enough to launch a massive direct frontal assault on a heavily fortified position. In the space of about a month, the Army of the Potomac had suffered around 50,000 casualties, which was about half the number of casualties it had suffered over the entire war up till that point. Many Northerners who were critical increased their description of Grant as a butcher, as did some of his own men, and symptoms of what we would now recognize as PTSD began to increase among soldiers in the Army of the Potomac. However, setting aside the moral issue of the body count, the fact remained that from a ruthlessly pragmatic point of view, over the course of the entire campaign, Lee's army had suffered more casualties in relative terms, that is, in proportion to the size of the army, and that, of course, Lee could not easily replace the men or even the supplies that had been lost or depleted during this campaign. Lee had clearly by this point lost the initiative in Northern Virginia, and barring some massive shift in the political situation, such as the election of a peace president in November, it would be just a matter of time until Lee's army would be ground into submission. Historians Williamson Murray and Wayne Sia, in their book A Savage War, A Military History of the Civil War, argue that Grant's grand strategy in 1864, which was basically to bring major pressure on all fronts simultaneously, while hitting Lee's army in particular as hard as possible, could have broken the Confederacy in 1864 if not for two factors. First, was that because of the timing of his promotion to lieutenant general, Grant had gotten a late start on the campaign for 1864 and hadn't been able to fully prepare as much as he might have liked. And secondly, and perhaps more importantly, quote, "The generals who were to pressure the Confederates in support of the major drives of Sherman and Meade, which were Banks against Mobile, Sigel up the Valley, and Butler up the James to Bermuda Hundred, all failed miserably. They were political generals, incapable of running an effective campaign," end quote, though they point out Grant actually didn't place any blame on them in his memoirs. But the incompetence of those generals, all of whom were the so-called political generals, this allowed Lee to actually get some reinforcements from elsewhere over the course of the campaign. After Cold Harbor, Grant's army moved to the James River with the goal of seizing the important railroad junction at the town of Petersburg near Richmond in order to isolate the Confederate capital. It was a major railroad junction through which a lot of supplies, both for the city of Richmond and for Lee's army, were coming through. Union engineers built a pontoon bridge across the river because there were large tidal shifts in the river, between high and low tide, and this pontoon bridge was over 2,000 feet long, and beginning on June 14th, the Army of the Potomac began crossing. Grant was basically trying to seize Petersburg, and even if Lee got there first, he would be forcing Lee into a siege situation, knowing that the Army of the Potomac would be in a much more advantageous situation relative to Lee's army under those conditions. Lee, for his part, had thought that Grant's objective when he began moving was the city of Richmond itself, in part because Grant had made a bit of a feint with some of his men moving in that direction. So Lee had only initially sent a small force of just 5,000 men to hold Petersburg under the command of General P.T. Beauregard. As the massive Union army began to approach, Beauregard's situation looked hopeless, but he put on a fake show in order to make his army appear to the approaching Federals as if it was much bigger than it really was, doing things like having the same groups of troops repeatedly march into the fortifications at Petersburg in a way to make it look like it was just massive amounts of Confederate reinforcements continually arriving. And they also did things like having a few of the locomotives that were parked at the Petersburg rail station burn steam and blow their whistles to make it seem as if lots of reinforcements were coming in by rail. This sort of thing had been done effectively to the Army of the Potomac in the past. Again, because the army just tended to be very cautious and slow and all these sorts of things, you could often fake them out and delay them for sometimes even a matter of days. And yet again, it worked. And when the first elements of the Army of the Potomac began to approach Petersburg, they believed they were facing a huge force and hesitated, waiting for more reinforcements of their own. Reinforcements who, again, characteristic of this army, were slow in coming. So that by the time the Army of the Potomac was ready to seriously strike at Petersburg, real Confederate reinforcements had made it into the town in large numbers, and they had built a formidable array of trenches and abatis and other fortifications. Union attacks on Petersburg were attempted over the course of 4 days, and all failed. Meade and Grant decided that further direct attacks would be pointless, so they settled in to lay siege instead. This siege, the Siege of Petersburg, which is going to unfold over many months, is going to be arguably the most World War I-like engagement of the American Civil War, with a whole bunch of sophisticated opposing trenches and fortifications, with very little real movement much of the time, a lot of doldrums, and even with sniper duels between the two opposing lines of trenches. Also, like World War I, this long, drawn-out trench warfare siege situation seems to have produced an unusual amount of psychological issues among the soldiers of both sides. Now, in these months of siege, there were periodic small and mid-sized battles, what you might consider battles within the battles, where one side or another attempted to do something. And perhaps the most interesting of the whole Siege of Petersburg is what became known as the Battle of the Crater. Now, as with his efforts against Vicksburg the previous year, Grant was willing to experiment with different options, some of them unorthodox. And in late June, a lieutenant colonel named Henry Pleasants, who was a mining engineer from Pennsylvania, came to his corps commander, who was Ambrose Burnside, with a proposal to dig a tunnel from the Union lines that would go all the way under the Confederate lines to a fort that was part of the Confederate defenses, and then to pack a large charge of gunpowder at the end of the tunnel underneath the fort and, of course, detonate it. The idea was this would obviously kill a bunch of Confederates in the initial explosion and would open up a big gap in their defenses. The tunnel they would dig would have to be about 500 feet long, and the gunpowder charge they would detonate under the Confederate fort would be about 4 tons. Burnside, Meade, and Grant greenlit the idea, though the latter two seemed to have maybe been a bit skeptical and seen it more as a way to keep some of the men busy, rather than as something that was really likely to work. Again, kind of how Grant had seen some of his unorthodox schemes to try and get at Vicksburg by digging canals and so on. So, it took these Pennsylvania coal miners from Pleasant's regiment over a month to build the tunnel, and they used ingenious methods to keep the air flowing into the tunnel and to keep it from getting filled with moisture, and they had to improvise a lot of their tools and materials because the Army of the Potomac really didn't provide them with, like, really good picks and shovels and other materials. So they had to really kind of MacGyver a lot of it, but they did eventually get it done. Now, the plan was, as this was being worked on, Burnside planned to send a division of colored troops, who were experienced, battle-hardened veterans, to be the first ones to exploit the aftermath of the explosion. But shortly before the gunpowder was to be detonated, Meade countermanded this plan and made sure that white troops would be the first ones into the breach. Now, the white division that was chosen to do this was selected by simply drawing straws, and the division that got the job was not nearly as experienced or competent or as trained and instructed in this particular mission as the black division who was originally going to do it. And in particular, the commander of this white division, who was a guy named James H. Ledley, was inexperienced and incompetent. In fact, when the fateful moment came, and the gunpowder was detonated and his troops were supposed to go, he wasn't even with his troops, but was well behind the Union lines, heavily drunk. The Union soldiers at first tried to detonate the gunpowder at 4:30 a.m. on the morning of July 30th, but they had some issues and had to, I guess, fix the fuses or something. And so supposedly around 4:44 in the morning, the gunpowder blew up, and it actually worked just as they'd hoped, blowing a significant hole in the Confederate lines that measured about 170 feet long, over 100 feet wide, and over 30 feet deep at its deepest. The explosion itself killed 278 Confederate soldiers and wounded and incapacitated, of course, many more than that. But after the explosion itself, nothing else went according to plan. Ledlie's division, like I said, were not properly instructed or prepared or equipped for what they were supposed to do, and they didn't even have proper ladders or bridges to get up and out of their own trenches quickly, so they ended up significantly delayed in trying to exploit the breach created by the explosion. Once they finally got across no man's land to where the crater was, Ledlie's men, again having not been instructed properly, went into the crater instead of around the crater, as the black soldiers had been instructed to do, because apparently they thought they should use the crater itself as kind of a trench or a rifle pit. However, because of all the delays, Confederate troops were already massing around the rim of the crater, and it quickly turned into, as one soldier put it, a turkey shoot, or as we might call it today, shooting fish in a barrel, and these Union soldiers began to be slaughtered, and many who weren't killed eventually surrendered, as the Confederates closed the gap in their lines. As this was happening, though, Burnside made the decision to try to reinforce failure by sending in the Black Division, of course, when the situation was already basically lost. And this would be the first time that Lee's soldiers had encountered black soldiers in battle, and as with so many other instances of black soldiers facing Confederates in a desperate losing situation, the Confederates were really not interested in taking black prisoners. The black soldiers ended up charging into the crater, as there were now Confederate soldiers massed around it, and they began to be slaughtered in the shooting gallery as well, many of them after attempting to surrender. There were even some cases in which white Union soldiers killed some of their own black comrades out of fear of Confederate reprisals against white Union soldiers who were fighting alongside black troops. Ultimately, around 500 black soldiers were killed in the crater, and only two black soldiers ended up being taken prisoner. Robert E. Lee, who was watching all this from about 500 yards away, made no effort to stop the slaughter of the black troops who were attempting to surrender. Grant wrote to Henry Halleck after the Battle of the Crater, quote, "It was the saddest affair I have witnessed in this war. Such an opportunity for carrying fortifications I have never seen and do not expect again to have," end quote. Later, in testimony to the Congressional Joint Committee on the Conduct of the War, Grant said, quote, "General Burnside wanted to put his colored division in front, and I believe if he had done so, it would have been a success. Still, I agreed with General Meade as to his objections to that plan. General Meade said that if we put the colored troops in front, we had only one division of them, and it would prove a failure, it would then be said, and very properly, that we were shoving these people ahead to get killed because we did not care anything about them. But that could not be said if we put white troops in front." End quote. So if this is true, then Meade's decision to not send the colored division in first, it wasn't due to him thinking they couldn't handle the job or to him trying to prevent them from getting the credit and glory if the attack ended up being successful, but more that he worried that the thing likely might not work well, and he didn't want to be accused of sending black troops into a suicidal disaster, which of course to some degree is what ended up happening anyway when Burnside sent them in as reinforcements. Ultimately, the Congressional Committee laid the primary blame for the Union disaster on Meade for his decision to change the plan of attack. Grant, years later, wrote of this battle, quote, "The effort was a stupendous failure. It cost us about 4,000 men, mostly, however, captured, and all due to inefficiency on the part of the Corps commander and the incompetence of the division commander who was sent to lead the assault," end quote. The Battle of the Crater could ultimately be seen as a tactical Confederate victory in a narrow sense, but it made no significant impact one way or the other on the overall siege itself, and the situation at Petersburg remained basically as it had before, a static, World War I-like siege of opposing trenches, with very little movement. In fact, the siege of Petersburg would not end before the Union election in November, nor would it end over the course of the remainder of the year 1864. Instead, it would drag on with periodic fighting of various sizes all the way until March of 1865. In a speech given to the Philadelphia Sanitary Commission while the siege of Petersburg was ongoing, Abraham Lincoln said, quote, "We accepted this war for an object, a worthy object, and the war will end when that worthy object is attained. Under God, I hope it never will end until that time. This war has taken 3 years. It was begun or accepted upon the line of restoring the national authority over the whole national domain. And for the American people, as far as my knowledge enables me to speak, I say we are going through on this line if it takes 3 years more." End quote. I guess, as Bob Dylan said, you don't count the dead when God's on your side.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He has trampled out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He has loosed the faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Thank you for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check out the website, profcj.org, or you can just put in dangeroushistorypodcast.com to get the show notes for this and every other Dangerous History Podcast episode. While you're there, you can email subscribe to the site over in the right-hand side, and if you put in your email address there and subscribe, you won't get any spam or anything like that from me, no junk email. You'll simply get an email notification every time something new is posted at my website. You can follow me and the show on Facebook and Twitter as well, and you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, however you prefer to consume your podcasts. If you enjoy and appreciate this show, there are many different ways you can help me keep this show going, growing, and constantly improving. One easy way is simply to spread the word about the Dangerous History Podcast to those you think might appreciate it who don't already know about it. And you can also help the show out by leaving ratings or reviews in venues such as iTunes, which helps the podcast get ranked more highly. If you would like to help out the show financially, there are many ways to do so, and you'll find them at profcj.org/donate. And one of the best, most helpful is to sign up to support the show via Patreon at patreon.com/profcj. And if you pledge a contribution of at least $5 per month or more, you'll have access to bonus episodes that I publish in Patreon available nowhere else, as well as the ability to join the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors private Facebook group. You can also make one-time or recurring donations via PayPal, and you can donate via Bitcoin as well. And of course, if you buy things from any of my Amazon affiliate links or my Abe Books affiliate links, go through those links, then do your shopping as normal, and the Dangerous History Podcast will get a small commission at no additional cost to you. This has been another episode of the Dangerous History Podcast, helping you learn the past so you can understand the present and prepare for the future.